You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Rita Nakashima Brock.
The Augustinian split between sex and intimacy continues in the secular culture in what might be called the Playboy view of women as sexual objects. This dualistic grammar undergirds a view of sex that carries no ethical commitment to relationships. As John Stoltenberg describes it, sexual freedom advocates have cast the issue only in terms of having sex that is free from suppression and restraint, sex that is free from fear, guilt, and shame, which in practical terms has meant advocacy of sex that is free from consequences, sex that is free from ethical distinctions, sex that is essentially free from any obligation to take into account that the other person is a person. It is nothing new to advocate sex that does not touch our souls or require lasting commitments. This is an old idea based on an ideology of the unfettered sexual drives of men. The difference is that Augustine thought there might be a problem here with the incompatibility of intimacy and sex, and I think he might be right. Christianity has also impacted women's participation in American democracy through its model of Christian virtue, which is related to marriage. The ideal Christian woman is to be without self-regard. Selfless giving to others is proof of the highest kind of love, which always puts others ahead of self. Love obeys authority, especially male authority in the church and home. Good women who follow this path of virtue are worthy of admiration, thanks, and praise for their goodness and virtue, and they should be celebrated for their angelic, self-sacrificing love. Despite a grammar that demonizes women's sexuality and sanctifies feminine virtues, women have also found a version of the Christian grammar useful for their own struggle for rights. Alongside this model of self-sacrificing feminine virtue has stood a prophetic model of virtue that emphasizes resistance to tyranny. This prophetic model emphasizes the commitment and courage of individuals who stand in the face of unjust authority and condemn it, and comes directly from the stories of Jesus in the Gospels, which is based in the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. Prophetic virtues rest neither in self-abnegation nor in personal gain or self-aggrandizement, but in a commitment to a more just and compassionate society that is free from oppression and that honors ethical personal relationships. While this prophetic grammar predates the feminist movement, it has been a bedrock of the women's rights movement in the United States. Antoinette Brown, the first woman in the U.S. ordained to the clergy, attended early women's rights conventions and interpreted the Bible in support of the movement. For most women reformers of the 19th century, including those who worked for women's rights, Christianity was the foundation of, not the enemy of, their work. Women's rights activists called upon a higher authority than the state, society, or culture, or even male clergy, in demanding changes in laws, policy, religious practice, and social attitudes. They invoke the higher authority of God against all social institutions, an authority higher than the Constitution, and this higher authority authorized their demands for equality. And they argued that, since spiritual power is not bound to material reality, biological sex had no bearing on its presence and power in women or men. They even sometimes used the traditional idea of feminine virtue to motivate women for reform. Anna Howard Shaw explained the suffering women would have to undergo if they fought for their rights in this way, and she says, "No man or woman has ever sought to lead his fellows to a higher or better mode of life without learning the power of the world's ingratitude. This is the penalty paid by good people who sacrifice themselves for others. They must live without sympathy. Their feelings will be misunderstood. The greatest test of the reformer's courage comes when, with a warm and earnest longing for humanity, she breaks for it the bread of truth, and the world turns from this life-giving power and asks instead of bread, a stone. I think Shaw reintroduces this virtue of suffering because the prophetic model of virtue was problematic for women. It is a masculine model of outrage, assertion, and courage. Women who lead social movements and act against oppression are often accused of being unnatural because we defy the feminine virtues assigned to us and use the prophetic ones reserved for men. This may be why so many 19th century Christian reformers tack back and forth between the feminine virtue and the prophetic impulse in steering a path toward justice. The spiritual realm of the Christian grammar has been important in motivating women's movements for social reform. Religious acts of imagination allow women to see beyond an exploitive or unjust state or social institution. Believing in something transcendent relativizes the power of the state. Such a vision has given women the courage to organize and work for justice. Through this vision, women found leverage to laugh at power, to be playful about the overly puffed up aspects of the purveyors of injustice. Without such acts of imagination, we are always in danger of struggling for equality within a system that cannot respect human beings because its values lie elsewhere. Without a means to see beyond the system we live inside, we run the risk of gaining equality with those who reinforce injustice. If we struggle for our rights only to join the ranks of those who inflict pain and injustice, we'll have fought for a status that costs us our souls. Because religion and the practice of democracy in the U.S. have been intertwined and gendered, feminist work within traditional religions is crucial for women's practice of democracy. The prophetic grammar is not just a model for challenging American forms of democracy. It has also been a powerful impetus for feminist critiques of traditional religion. In making the complex gendered grammars of religion explicit, feminist scholars of traditional religions both seek to challenge and transform their traditions and to set their own terms for staying within these legacies. Whatever the conscious choices we make, at a deep level, we are shaped by our earliest religious grammars. This is evident in the approach of some white feminists who have turned to religions from outside Europe. Their use of Asian Buddhism treats it as if it were like Protestantism. They use Buddhist ideas such as reincarnation or personal enlightenment as if they were beliefs to adopt for individual well-being. They ignore how Buddhism acts in Asia and how it is embedded in societies which oppress women. In Asia, Buddhism is used to connect people to their ancestors rather than as a means to explore individual past lives or to seek personal fulfillment. In other words, the Euro-American use of Buddhism emphasizes personal belief in its ideas rather than adoption of its forms. This reduction of a complex tradition to a set of ideas also occurs in relation to Native American traditions. In appropriating Native American traditions, Euro-Americans tend to ignore kinship lineages, the intricacies and requirements of ritual, site-specific spiritual manifestations, and actual relationships to living people. Instead, they focus on abstract values such as respect for nature, or healing, which is not how these traditions define themselves. After they have been Protestantized, these religious traditions can then be commodified and marketed for the individual consumer, as is currently happening with Tibetan Buddhism. As Native American scholar Inez Talamantes notes, the belief that the tradition of others may be appropriated to serve the needs of self is a peculiarly Western notion that relies on a belief that knowledge is disembodied rather than embodied in relationships intimately tied to place and entails responsibilities to others and a commitment and discipline in learning. The problem here is that the Protestant grammar of a divided world has given us a secular society that is spiritually vacuous. The secular grammar lacks ways for people to feel significant beyond their own individual lives, earning potential, and ability to consume. Living in that vacuum, people begin to look for spiritual grounding. Since the overriding value system of the secular culture is capitalism, consumerism has become the secular religion substitute. People visit its vast temples, called malls, for hours, to leave offerings by cash or credit card, in exchange for commodities that satisfy an artificially constructed set of needs determined by the missionaries of advertising. Since the needs are manufactured by advertising, they can be an unending source of motivation for people to consume products that are supposed to make them feel better because the missionaries have convinced them that they are in need of improvement through these products. The forms of improvement usually rely on our being disembodied, on our regarding ourselves and our bodies as objects to be worked on, clothed, encased, adorned, fragranced, or reduced. In constructing human needs and marketing a product to meet those needs, consumerism parallels the way religion sometimes works by promising salvation for something the religion has decided is a core problem for human beings. Like religious revivals, product fads sweep consumers in a frenzy during the festival seasons when purchasing goods is the main activity, such as Christmas, which is the biggest consumer festival season. But consumerism, like some forms of religion, leaves us hollow, ungrounded in anything that feels deeply real. By real, I mean that which touches us in our psyches and souls, that which gives us a resting point and a sense of connection to significance beyond our personal lives and possessions. Religion, when it works, addresses core human needs that consumerism cannot touch. These are the needs arising from embodied life in complex relationships and from our needs not to be dissociated from ourselves and our relationships. Our need for a good story when the facts are too dry and relentless. Our need to experience passion and joy when boredom makes life a drab, muddy chore. Our need for the wisdom of a legacy of knowledge when we do not know what to do. Our need to conquer demons, addictions, and violence when they take over our lives. And our need to remove the razor in our hearts when we face inconsolable loss. When, inevitably, we face our human failings and limits, many of us return or turn to religion. People still turn to religion in its more traditional forms to address these needs, partly because the long historical trajectories of religion ground individual needs in a larger universe, in a grammar that gives individual lives significance beyond themselves and offers a future based in long historical memory. And whether it works well or poorly, religion performs powerful tasks in every human society. The long-standing Protestant grammar of the dominant culture is now failing as the modernism of the Enlightenment is failing. While the Protestant grammar has undergirded much social reform, including movements for women's rights, the religious aspect of the grammar has lost its traction. It needs new treads. It no longer provides a grammar adequate for understanding how a democratic society can protect religions not based on belief and how American democracy can respect women. I suggest we need to rethink the dualistic separation of the sacred from the world. In an earlier time, when empires claimed total power over religion, economics, and culture, the world might need to be resisted and opposed. But in accepting this form of totalitarianism and constructing an alternative vision, the Protestant grammar created two long-enduring problems. First, the vision of another world of justice was still authoritarian and totalitarian, headed by a benevolent deity, a male dictator who required absolute obedience. Authoritarian models interfere with our capacities to be creative and think wisely. Second, the division into two spheres is too simplistic and ignores a variety of interconnected dimensions in which human beings live, some of which provide dissident space that resists misuses of power. Human beings inhabit intricate interpersonal worlds of kinship, friendship, and culture that shape us. We interact with a rich biological world. We struggle to understand the complex world of our physical, psychological, and mental lives. The separation that provided a transcendent vision of another world of justice is based on too extreme and comprehensive a split. The dualistic split creates a polarized system of reactions based on struggles for power. The rejection of the world comes, perhaps, at too great a cost, not only to us as human beings, but also to the planet, which is our home. It rests on a radical act of dissociation from our own embodiment and denial of our dependencies on each other and on our biological lives. In key ways, including our role in human reproduction, women differ biologically from men, but we live in an economic system of work and achievement based on the biology of men and the social construction of traditional masculinity as transcending the contingencies of dependency and vulnerability. Augustine was right when he said there were aspects of human life not under the control of the rational will. But he was wrong to identify that dimension solely with sin and to split it into profaned existence. Much of what is satisfying about human life and what makes us feel whole cannot be controlled by conscious acts of will or by rationality. For example, sleep, recovery from illness, gestation, lactation, emotional and physical maturation, the creation of intimacy, sexual satisfaction, the amelioration of trauma, the integration of loss, and relief from stress. The erosion of time for these activities or unwelcome intrusions that interrupt these aspects of our lives make us more susceptible to control by others and more susceptible to a system of consumption that is not concerned with human well-being but with profits. The traditional Protestant grammar splits us away from too much that we need to reclaim about the world that gives us breathing space from the constant encroachment of consumerism and its vacuous needs and solutions. I suggest that the source of the vision of an alternative to injustice comes from glimpses of respect, love, and freedom we find in our actual lived worlds of relationships and not from a transcendent world. We abstract these experiences into imaginative visions and communicate them as forms of hope for change, but they come from embodied, lived experience. The Christian grammar that affirms this kind of presence and embodiment is called incarnation, dwelling in the flesh in all its complex ambiguities. Can we construct a democracy that respects difference as a value, that gives to land, animals, and vegetation intrinsic value, that undermines the power of profit as the engine of economics and politics, that respects women and protects children, and that allows space for differently religious people to participate in public life with minimal interference from the heavy hand of the state? I don't know, but I think it's worth thinking about. Thank you.
Despite what you said about the use of of religion for purposes of resisting the status quo or the grammar. Still, there is a problem that progressively over generations, younger people, for example, now are less religious than their parents were. And their lack of religious, there's no agnosticism or anything. It's just a progressive falling away of those values. But yet, at the same time, whenever there is a crisis here, for example, the shooting or complaining about the educational system, the tendency, particularly in minority culture and black culture, is to reinforce then the community of religion, and it doesn't come in its feminist or radical sense. So how do you deal with the problem, the guilt and the problem that's caused by younger people and children? You said the upbringing was important. And the question of, on the one hand, of letting religion in this tradition fall away by itself, and the use of it by the state and the church and the teachers and everybody as a way of controlling Americans from falling apart.
There's sort of several ways into what you're asking that I think of. One is that I think, in fact, there's a lot about traditional Christianity and claims it makes that are untenable, and smart people figure this out and leave. You know, the claims about God and evil. There are all these, I think it's in fact easier to reject religion when you have that sacred secular split, and then the sacred begins to look like it's not really there. So I think that in fact the sort of decline of mainline Protestantism and the increasing secularization of the culture is partly a product of the way Christianity has worked traditionally. But I in fact think that belief isn't what religion is about anyway. I actually think that most people in the world are religious because it's the means by which they construct a world that's a world of relationships and care and endurance of suffering and a whole lot of things that affect us as social human beings. I think that one of the insidious aspects of consumerism is its increasing individualization of human beings. The more it separates us from relationships of intimacy that are long-term. There is a fellow, I believe, at the Schlesinger Library who is writing a book on the family home. And she explains that in the last 20 years, the family home is increased in size something like 30%, even as the American family has shrunk. And that increase in size is in private spaces. It's in more bathrooms. Everybody wants their own private bathroom. They don't want to have to smell any other human being. And everybody wants a private bedroom. And I remember a story in the New York Times about a young woman who had hid her boyfriend in her bedroom for 2 months and her parents didn't know. That this is how separated and alienated we have become, that we don't like to be reminded that other people have bodies or to share space with people. We live in such separate spaces that we don't do this constant contact and interaction and talking. And I actually think it's that sustains religion, not belief. And we're losing that as well to the consumer society.
In your definition of religion, you were separating belief from this other list of things, the amelioration of stress and the whole list that you had.
Yeah.
Don't you see all of, or a good percentage of that list supposedly and hopefully being taken care of by secular education, secular social and medical entities? So that you have all of these professions and agencies and what have you who supposedly are handling all of those things that you mentioned. And yet, those things are not being taken care of, so that we still see people saying, I'm still too stressed, I'm still not handling my grief, I'm still not taking care of all those things. So then, since those things don't seem to be able to be taken care of, or we haven't found the way of taking care of them in a secular manner, you begin to hear, well, maybe we need a more faith-based approach. This is the talk that you hear very much of in things like drug addiction and other addiction problems and what have you. So where do you come down on on that, on how maybe at some point there's a coming back together, a dovetailing of some aspect of belief within the satisfaction of handling those things. And just one other statement about when you were talking about the size of the home. Paulo Soleri was dealing with that whole factor and how we get so separated into our little homes, our little yards. We have everything we need. We don't need our neighbors. And then we end up using up all of the land. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the natural spaces, et cetera. So he was really busy talking about that stuff.
Yeah, I've been to his place at Arcosanti.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's an abnegation of the state's responsibility to expect religious institutions and women to do for free the functions that the state should do, which is educate, provide health care, the whole list of things. So I don't advocate that religion take that over. I think it's the job of the Commonwealth for all of us to take care of those functions. If people want to do those things voluntarily, that's their business, but I think it's also a responsibility of what my tax dollars should be doing instead of building missiles. So I don't advocate that. But I do think that what religion provides is a way to hang all that together, because right now it's pieced out in parts. So there's, you know, you go to the hospital for this, and you go to the therapist for this, and then you go to the shopping mall for this, and then you go to the whatever, social club for this and school for that. And there is a kind of fragmentation that happens in this secular culture, and religion is a way to pull all that back together. It isn't a thing to provide those services, but it's a way we try to live more whole. And that's important. It's also a place for imagination and play. I think we forget that ritual is in fact a kind of playing, and that the stories we tell in ritual are important aspects of whole other imagination and part of ourselves that isn't school or medicine or any of those other things. And it's that that helps us pull it together.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Roscos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.